Imagine suddenly losing an entire month's worth of income. That would be enough to ruin many Hawaii residents. It's an all-too-real situation for two coffee farmers on Hawaii Island's Kona Coast. The mother and daughter have been the victims of a string of recent thefts. Hundreds of pounds of raw coffee, worth thousands of dollars, have been taken straight from their trees under cover of darkness. Adrienne McLish is the owner and operator of Wild Mac Coffee Company in South Kona. She brought this problem to our attention and shared her experience with our producer, Ryan Finnerty.
They come in the middle of the night, and they pick our coffee. And I've seen footprints. They're coming from up above. They're coming. I hear trucks drop people off, you know. Then I hear voices. I walk my dog out by my garage. And, they, you know, because our property's like on an incline, so our coffee's really hard to pick. But we've got pathways everywhere. My mom, she's 74 years old. I'm 53. I'm handicapped, you know. But we go out there to pick coffee. The next day, it's gone. Gone. Branches on the ground. Coffee on the ground, you know, because they were out there in the middle of the night picking it.
So, Adria, if nothing was happening and all was well, how much coffee per month, let's say, would you be harvesting on your farm?
Oh, my God. A month, probably 1,500 pounds.
And by your estimation, how much has been stolen from the property so far?
Oh, probably triple 1,500, 3,500 pounds.
Over what period of time?
In about a month and a half,
so
since the season started.
So, I mean, you've had more than a month's worth of products
stolen. Yeah.
What's the financial impact to your farm of that?
It's bad. It's bad. We're getting like 187 a pound because we wait. So do the math. That's a lot of money. You know, my mom wanted to go to the mainland and see her brother. Well, that ain't going to happen.
So, Adria, what steps have you taken since these thefts started occurring?
Well, I've called the police. We went down to the police department, filed a report. The police been up here three times, and they said they can't keep coming up here. It's not just us. It's happening everywhere. Everywhere, from South Kona to Kaloko, everywhere. When I go downtown, I was just at Ross's. I was talking to this Filipino man. It happened to his family members. Happened to him personally. You know, talked to the flag man down at Kealakekua post office. Five members of his family got hit, you know, and they live south. You know, it's not just us, but we're two women. And the police officer said, don't go out there in the middle of the night, you know, because you don't know if they have weapons, you know, and they're bigger than you. They could hurt you. So we're not going to go out there in the middle of the night no more. It's dangerous.
And so did the police give you any specific advice on how to handle this situation?
They said to stay in. They didn't really give us any advice. They were really nice gentlemen, you know, and they were really helpful, but we were just went downtown to go drop off our 33 pounds of coffee. What a shame. I mean, that's nothing. Nothing, you know? And that takes a lot of walking around to get that, and you walk around and there's nothing out there because they come in the middle of the night. You know, and on my dog, I have a little chihuahua, you know, and she barks, you know, and what do? I mean, I go out there to take her to the bathroom, I hear them talking in the forest, because we have ohia trees and macadamia trees and the coffee's in between, you know. They come right out my window, Ryan, and pick my coffee in the middle of the night.
And Adria, you said this has been happening to a lot of other farmers in the area.
Oh, yeah.
Have other people reported thefts to the police?
They're afraid of the police. I hate to say that.
Why is that?
I don't know. You know, they just want to keep their lives private. We keep telling them, report it. You know, I mean, a lot of people are just not inclined to call the police, I guess. And, you know, they're out to serve us. They're not the bad guys. They're the good guys, right? I mean, everybody needs to know that the police are out to protect us. You know, I've called them. I'm not a real police caller, but who do you call?
So I want to ask you about another thing, Adria. It's my understanding that when there's a transfer of an agricultural product, of which coffee is considered, that there needs to be some documentation that goes from the seller to the buyer, that the transporter gets. It's called a C6 form from the Hawaii
right.
Department of Agriculture, and it identifies the buyer
that
and the seller.
You have a number.
Right, the tax ID number.
Right.
And it's my understanding that a sale cannot legally occur without this type of documentation, but obviously if
the
product's stolen.
Well, these people, Ryan, have their own processing plants, but at the end of the line, they got to pay taxes, right? I mean, they're taken away from the taxpayers. They're taken away from the road, taken away from the schools. They're taken away from the grocery stores, taken away from Christmas money. They're taken away from everything. You know, they're thieves. They don't care.
So, Adria, how many people would it take to pick the amount of coffee that's being stolen from you? And the second question.
Probably six, four, five, six, you know. And we were coming. We went down to go to the to KTA, and there was a truckload of people coming up. And they covered their faces. And they drive up and they drop them off, Ryan. And they come back and pick them up in a big truck and load up the coffee. You know, I get out there. I'm handicapped. We're up in the forest. It starts raining. You keep picking. I lose my cane constantly. My mom finds it, something. It's just her and I.
How long can you financially sustain this theft before it puts you out of business?
Oh, God. My mom just wants to give up. You know, it's not even worth going out there and picking coffee. You know, I mean, like we took in 35 pounds for a day's pick. That's nothing.
What would be a normal day's pick?
At least 100 pounds. They ran over our gate. We had a chain at the bottom of the driveway. They ran it over. They came up and ran it over, Ryan. They dug the post out of the ground and ripped the chain out.
So, Adria, what would you like to see from either the police or the county government there on Hawaii Island to help address this problem?
My mom wanted me to ask, is there any kind of restitution fund for people that have been robbed, you know, from the county? We're poor people. We're on Social Security, and we supplement our money with our coffee. We have to pay taxes, you know, property taxes. Our Social Security doesn't cover it. Our coffee covers it. And now we don't have any coffee.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Adria, and best of luck to you.
Well, Ryan, if we can just get the word out there, don't be afraid. Call the police. Call your neighbors. Call someone. Let's be a community. Let's stick together.
Adria McClish, along with her mother, Kathy, are the owners and operators of Wild Mac Coffee Company in South Kona. We'll continue exploring the issue of coffee theft on the Kona Coast throughout the week on The Conversation.
In 1967, the state of Hawaii enacted a unique program that set a national precedent and inspired other states. The Art in Public Places program started after the legislature passed the Art in State Buildings Law. Under it, 1% of the construction costs of a new state building would be designated for the acquisition of works of art, either by commission or purchase. On Oahu, it's easy to come across pieces of art commissioned or bought by the program. For example, the Hawaii Convention Center's bronze Gift of Water statue or the Waikiki Aquarium's Tropical Sounds ceramics. Throughout the course of the program, more than 500 works have been commissioned and more than 5,000 purchased or acquired by other means. In 1970, the first commissioned art piece was placed at the newly constructed Hilo State Office Building. Crafted by local artist Edward Brownlee, the piece was a sculpture made out of weathering steel. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the name of this sculpture? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right will get a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Omer Kursat from Waimanalo. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Ira Flatow here, and soon I'll be there in Hawaii. Join me at First Take with Science Friday, when I'll be accompanied on stage by scientists from your community. These two science-filled evenings in Honolulu and on the Big Island are open to HPR members only. So become a member today and get your seats at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Sponsored in part by Sacred Hearts Academy.
Waikiki has security challenges all its own, with a dense population, many of whom are in transit, crowded streets, and a hospitality industry dependent on keeping those streets secure. A recent spate of violent incidents in Waikiki has focused attention on security issues there, and Neighborhood Board Chair Robert Finley came to our studio earlier this morning to talk about them.
Basically, there have been four incidents where we've had what I think are unconnected events. Mm-hmm. We've had a shooting, which is very rare. According to the news, it was done by a person who'd only lived here 2 weeks and had a criminal record. He's of course, not been to court or anything. We've had allegedly a 16-year-old boy stab and kill a Marine. And we've had a 14-year-old boy, I believe, use a baseball bat and attack another, I believe it was a service member. We've also had what's reportedly a homeless person attack a Canadian tourist looking for money. These things do not happen very often in Waikiki.
But you understand why, having those things having happened, Robert, that somebody might be asking you, as I am now, you know, what's going on in Waikiki? What's the security situation there?
Well, I've spoken to the District 6 commander, Major Sugimoto, and this was during a time when we were trying to get a new police chief and a lot of confusion, I believe, at police department. He is assigning his assets, his officers, in a different manner today than he was then. Obviously, it would be no good if I told you that he's putting X number here and X number there, because that wouldn't...
But he's addressing
it completely. I believe every year time we graduate a new police academy class, those people are split in half. Half go to Chinatown, half go to Waikiki.
Yeah.
You can tell by the great influx of jaywalking tickets that the very enthusiastic young police officers are there.
Sure.
But more importantly, I think they're all going to be assigned to Waikiki, and it's going to do a presence thing where you'll see uniform officers in more places. At the same time, we are a visitor industry, and we can't make it Fortress Waikiki, because who would come to visit something like that?
And that's a delicate balance that you, from your position, you've been able to observe. You have to observe from where you are. Yeah?
Absolutely. As chair of the neighborhood board, I represent the residents, of course, and we've worked very well with the visitor industry and the police department to combine our forces to address these issues. The major thing we see right now, of course, is just like in the 70s, homeless. I think that's more of a state issue, because the ones that are really the issue are those who have who are bipolar and have mental issues that the state is just not capable of treating. And we'd love to see those people be treated and taken care of.
Are they in evidence in Waikiki?
Oh, yes. You've got the screaming woman. You've got all this sort of thing going on. Our residents complain that their condos become homes for overnight homeless people who defecate and urinate in their parking stalls. The police are constantly called to trespass these people. And I just don't see a solution, actually, unless the state is willing to stand up and really increase the number of facilities to help the ones that aren't able to help themselves.
Well, incidents like the ones you describe are very manpower intensive for the police department, right?
Absolutely. And they do their best. It's a hard balancing act at the police department. Are you going to try to prevent a murder, or are you going to throw a homeless person off of private property? You know, where do we go from there? Do they go after people riding bicycles on sidewalks, which has really increased since Beaky came along? Or do they, attempt to prevent shoplifting? Who knows? It's a really difficult task.
What you just said about bicycling is goes against the claim that they've made lately in the city that they're actually taking bikes off the sidewalks. You're seeing the opposite effect in Waikiki?
2 days ago, 6 of them almost ran me off the sidewalk. Yes, I've seen it.
These are a couple of the challenges, and there are many, but what do you see are the specific challenges for police in Waikiki, keeping Waikiki secure?
I see it as several things. First, the presence. We've got the bike officers now. We do have, I'm sure there's going to be more undercover. We've got the people that the Waikiki Business Improvement District Association pays the police. They pay them, I believe, $75,000 a year to take off-duty officers and put them on special duty in Waikiki, generally out of uniform. So on the police side, I think we're addressing it well. On the prosecution side, every time you see most of the times when you see a major incident, that person has got a long list of arrests and very few convictions. I don't know if that's because we don't have enough prison space or if the prosecutor is addressing other issues than what we see as minor crime. Shoplifting and stuff like that, which has become a major issue in Waikiki.
You're familiar with the broken window theory, that if you heavily enforce incidents like the one you described, that all crime goes down? That has been a practice in some police departments. I'm wondering if it might be applicable here.
I think it would be difficult because we went through the era in the 60s when I was still in high school of Metro Squad with people like Larry Mayhew and his guys who enforced crime on the street. And our good friends over at the ACLU, of course, screamed and took action, and our elected officials decided that was not a good way to do crime.
A get tough policy.
Yes. I know the new police chief said she is trying to change the image from tough to your friend. I hope that works. But we do have some people running around that absolutely need to be addressed by a police officer and perhaps arrested, needs to be prosecuted. I see the frustration with the police department where they spend a year investigating a drug dealer, pick them up, provide the case, and it's not important enough to prosecute, or it's not done well. And hopefully that will change a little bit.
It sounds as if your immediate wish is just to see more street enforcement in Waikiki.
I definitely would like to see more street enforcement, but it has to be balanced. We can't grab a tourist from Japan who jaywalks and put him in jail. That's not a good idea. But at the same time, if you have a pimp who's recruited a 13-year-old girl from Kailua, I would love to see that person in jail.
Robert Finley is the chairman of the Waikiki Neighborhood Board and an ex officio member of the Waikiki Improvement Association.
Hi, I'm John Purcell from Monsanto Vegetables. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HBR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple Store or Google Play.
Hawaii's senior Senator Brian Schatz finds himself in an awkward position, one that has become a great deal more awkward in recent weeks. He's a member of the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Ethics, a position that will soon force him to sit in judgment on his fellow senator and fellow Democrat Al Franken, among others. Civil Beach Chad Blair has more on the senator's hot seat in today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Hi, Chris.
Al Franken announced just within the last 24 hours that he's not stepping down, making life a little tougher for his colleagues, yeah?
Yes, and of course, he has been charged with sexual harassment, at least two incidents, one before he became a senator, one after. If I read my Twitter feed correctly, there might have been another report or two, but these sexual harassment claims seem to be coming more and more. With Franken, he is a Democrat. He's well-liked in the Senate. But how uncomfortable will it be for Schatz to have to stand in judgment? We should say, by the way, Franken has totally cooperated. He has apologized, and he actually said, sure, let's have this ethics investigation. But, boy, that's got to be difficult for someone who's your colleague.
Well, the trouble with an ethics investigation like this is that all the details are going to be aired out and will probably sort of trickle out gradually, occupying several days of the news cycle, yeah?
Probably even longer. I mean, what I hear, these things can take months. The last time the Senate Ethics Committee, and I'm not speaking for the House, which has its own set of problems. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of John Conyers. But it can take months and months. It's been about 6 years since the Senate side really has had to deal with something, but the guy that they had to deal with is still in the news as well. That's Bob Menendez. Mm-hmm. He's from New Jersey. They were looking into him. And then, of course, that went before the Justice Department. There was a mistrial. Anyway, that's a different issue. It has to do with abuse of office. But just the Menendez case alone as an example is it takes a while for the Senate to do its investigation. They have to subpoena. They have to consider all complaints. It could be something that might even affect the 2018 elections.
From a, you know, public relations perception point of view, this is kind of a nightmare for the Democrats.
It is. Remember, the Republicans got their own set of problems regarding sexual harassment. And if Roy Moore from Alabama is elected in December, and that's a close race against mm-hmm. Doug Jones, the Democrat, I mean, there's already talk on the part of Republicans who are in the majority that they might expel him. And that is something that could be done from the Ethics Commission as well. And so that's a complicating factor. And I need not even raise the example of the White House and the Access Hollywood tape. But sexual harassment, these claims are coming more and more. And while it's predominantly politics, Hollywood, journalism, one wonders whether there's any end in sight.
Well, may not be. But in in terms of politics, the thing that's different about Franken, maybe the only thing that's different about Franken, is that he is freely admitted to all this right off the top. I don't think that's true of any of the other members of Congress who are the subject of accusations. Is that right?
No, I think Conyers has been very resistant, although there was a settlement that was done, but the details weren't disclosed. In the case of Roy Moore, he absolutely denies allegations from 40 years ago that he, as a young man in his 30s, sought out the company of teens, 14, 15, 16 years old. So, no, they have not acknowledged that. Will that help Franken? Possibly. I know Mazie Hirono was on MSNBC last week, another Democrat, another senator, who said, look, this is a distraction as to whether he should resign or not. The bigger issue is that we are finally talking about sexual harassment, sexual abuse, sexual impropriety. And she said right on TV, she said, look, every woman knows this. I've experienced it, others. Thank God we're finally getting to the bottom of it. And she gave credit to Franken for at least coming out and saying, I apologize. There will be, and I think today he said, this is just not going to happen going forward.
You know, one of the things that I think that just the sheer weight of accusations, and we should say that most of these have not yet been you know, proven their allegations, and they remain allegations. But it doesn't seem as if we're going back to the world before Harvey Weinstein, does it?
No, but I'll say two words: Bob Packwood. And there's a senator back in '95 that did go before the Senate Investigation Ethics Committee and was found to have done some pretty awful things. And by the way, he stepped down, the Republican from Oregon.
Yeah, point taken, Chad. That's one to remember. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair.
Hi, this is Dabney Goff of HPR's New Generation Listen. If you're a younger listener of this station, join us on November 28th at Aloha Beer Company for a behind-the-scenes tour of the brewery and a chance to hang out with like-minded HPR lovers. We'll also be picking an HPR Gen Listen beer. And since it's Giving Tuesday, all proceeds from the sales of this beer in December will go to our favorite public radio station. Space is limited, so reserve your spot today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Public sector unions are widely seen as some of the creators of the American middle class, and that's especially true here in Hawaii, where public sector union membership is so strong. Here, when you go to work for the state or county, you sign up as a union member automatically and pay dues accordingly. The lack of an option troubles Robert Ault of the Buckeye Institute, a free market-focused think tank on the mainland. He wonders why workers aren't being given a choice of union membership and says most workers agree with him.
It's something where I think a lot of them don't recognize that there could be the possibility of them having a choice, not a choice between unions and a choice as to whether or not they have a union representing them. And in large measure, I think that goes to, you know, a number that when I first heard it, I found it fairly startling, and that's that 94% of unionized workers in this country have never had the opportunity to vote for the union that's representing them. And in large measure, that's because, to use the example that you gave, the individuals, you know, began their employment after the union was elected as the bargaining representative. Let me give one example just to sort of paint a picture. I live in Columbus, Ohio. The local union for the teachers is the Columbus Teachers Association, and they were voted in as the collective bargaining agent back in the late 60s when Nixon was in the White House and the Beatles were still together.
Right.
But if you walk into an elementary school classroom, the teacher who's teaching up in front in my neighborhood, they like weren't even born then.
Right.
So in terms of that, they inherited a union. I've never had the opportunity to have a vote as to what union's representing them or whether they wish to be represented by that union.
Do they do much complaining about that?
You know, the complaint I hear quite a bit about is it goes to accountability. 85% of union workers who we've polled think that having regular periodic elections for their union, as they've done in a couple of states, creates greater accountability. And on the flip side, if you go to our website, workervotingrights.org, you'll find the president of one of the major public sector unions, I believe it was AFSCME, was quoted after one of the states enacted a worker voting rights reform piece of legislation. They admitted that, look, before the reform came in place, we were taking our members for granted. We weren't even communicating well with them. And they instituted reforms once they had to stand for regular election. Goes to just the basic principle that competition is good. Allowing the workers to have a voice is good, and increases the accountability of those unions to their workers.
Union advocates I'm trying to speculate as to what kind of arguments you might get back, and one of them, of course, would have been the Public Workers Union have done an enormous amount of good for their members, right?
In which case, those unions will do very well at the polls. In fact, if you take a look, Iowa has worker voting rights, and they just had elections. Very high participation from workers in that state in the elections, and the vast majority, I think it was something like 88% or more of the unions that stood for re-election were recertified, which is to say they were doing a good job, the workers were happy, they went ahead and voted for them. In other states, at times where the unions haven't been providing those services, the workers end up voting them out. This isn't something that's predetermined in terms of the outcome. This simply actually empowers the workers to actually be able to exercise that choice and to have a voice with regard to their representation.
When you say that there's a need for greater accountability, have there been instances of public worker unions really abusing their power and taking advantage of that lack of accountability?
Oh, I think certainly you can point to examples with regard to corruptions that have occurred in certain unions. But I think the issue is less about real abuse and more a question of just management and sort of the direction of the union. A lot of the unions end up engaging in a lot of political activity on behalf of one party or another, sometimes in ways that their rank and file membership may or may not agree with. They engage in certain collective bargaining that, for instance, that may not be consistent with what it is that the workers in that union wish for. But again, if they don't actually have the opportunity to have a vote with regard to which union represents them, there's not as strong of a check to align the union's activities with the interests of the membership.
When a union is firmly in place and has the power, as a public workers union does, I would think the last thing it would want would be to throw open the lists to competition with itself.
Well, in terms of that, I can certainly understand. I think most of us would love it if we could get elected once with a one-and-done election in which we never had to stand for re-election. That would be nice, but in America, we tend to believe that having elections increases accountability and make sure that the representatives are actually representing our interests. And I think that applies as well to public sector unions. Particularly in states where there's not a right-to-work system, where, again, the requirement is that you have to pay your union dues or your agency fees as a condition of employment, and if you fail to do so, you can be fired. That raises some fundamental fairness questions if you've never had the opportunity to even have a say, to have a vote with regard to which union represents you or whether you wish to have the union that's representing you do so. There have been cases, even in states where they don't have worker voting rights, where individuals have been successful in switching from one union to another, but those are really more the exception than the rule. It's so difficult to decertify a union and to be able to bring another union in. You don't see much competition. But with a system of worker voting rights, I think that would actually really open up potential choice for workers.
The situation you describe of essentially mandatory union membership if you're going to get a public workers' jobs, how prevalent is that across the country?
In any state that is not right to work presently, trying to recall the number, there's been a couple of states that have added right to work recently. So I think just recently it tipped, so the majority of states are right to work such that they cannot condition employment on paying union dues or fees. I think it's something in the ballpark of 26 states are right to work, but obviously Hawaii is not right to work. Ohio, where I live, is not right to work. And so in both of those states, it is a condition of employment that you pay either your union dues to be a member or your agency fees.
Are you feeling a groundswell in your direction moving toward this?
The interesting thing is just the overwhelming support among workers. There's been quite a bit of polling done on this. And nationwide, the support ranges from 82 to 85% in a variety of polls. In Ohio, where I live, we oversampled union households to get a sense of where unions stood versus non-union members. Union households polled 90% in favor of requiring regular periodic votes for union representation. I've been in the public policy game a long time. That's extraordinary. And I think the interesting thing is the support among union households was far greater than the support among non-union households. And I think it's because they genuinely desire to have the authority and the opportunity to be able to actually vote for their union representation.
It'll be interesting to see if that kind of support translates into a really widespread public pressure, won't it?
It is. So far, you've seen a few states that have adopted this reform, and more states are considering it. Recently, Congress, a piece of legislation was introduced. I think there's a second piece that was already pending in Congress. I tend to think, once again, that given what's happened in Washington, not just in recent days, but in recent years, I don't tend to be terribly optimistic about seeing major reform pass through through Washington. But I do think, given the widespread support among workers, that you could see a cascading effect in the states.
Robert Ault is the president and CEO of the Buckeye Institute, a free market-focused public policy think tank based in Columbus, Ohio. You can find a link to the group's work on today's edition of the Conversation podcast on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha mai kākou. This is Ku'uipo Kumukahi, Manager of Hawaiian Culture and Community Relations at the Hyatt Regency Waikiki, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, plus what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we're tapping into the expertise of Christopher Phillips. He's on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do we have this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. For this week, stargazers, look out for Mars and Jupiter in the morning sky during sunrise. The moon this week will be approaching its full phase, so expect stargazing for those faint objects to be fairly challenging.
You mentioned Mars. I know we're searching for the missing water on Mars.
Oh, yes. And as it turns out, planetary scientists may have jumped the gun a little when it came to the announcement of seasonal flows of liquid water on the Martian surface. What we thought were outflows of water on the dunes of Mars were in fact changing sand formations. As is the case in most deserts, this water may have been a scientific mirage.
And you don't sound surprised by that. What's a little more insight, Chris?
Well, the big clue as to why there is no water flowing on the surface of Mars is in its atmosphere, or perhaps lack of it. Atmospheric pressure on Mars is barely there, and so one would expect liquid water to just simply boil away. To expect it flowing on the surface seems like a long shot.
And this doesn't mean there isn't some water flowing up there. It may just be underground or maybe in a place we can't see.
Absolutely. In fact, there could totally be water underground, and lots of it. In fact, spacecraft data has provided tantalizing evidence that suggests that Mars may actually harbor a lot of liquid water deep beneath the surface, or perhaps locked up in permafrost.
And what would they do if the rover ran into a river or something like that? It's not really made for going in the water.
Right. But luckily, the chances of that are zero, because we don't expect to see any liquid water flowing on the surface.
And more seriously, we know that water did flow in the past there, so it's not like something that never happened.
Absolutely. The Martian surface is strewn with geological evidence that in the past, huge volumes of liquid water covered the surface. We see dried up riverbeds, lakes, and even empty oceans.
Well, here's hoping to find a nice fresh flowing one soon up there. Christopher Phillips and another fascinating report. Thank you.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer. We keep Stargazer at HawaiiPublicRadio.org, by the way.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, providing research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In this morning's quiz, we took a look at a unique program enacted by the state of Hawaii in 1967. It set a national precedent and inspired other states. The Art in Public Places program came out of the Art in State Buildings Law. That law appropriated 1% of the construction costs of a new state building to acquire works of art, either by commission or purchase. On Oahu, the Hawaii Convention Center's bronze Gift of Water statue are the Waikiki Aquarium's Tropical Sound ceramics are examples of program purchase pieces. More than 500 works have been commissioned and over 5,000 purchased are acquired by other means through the Art in Public Places program. In 1970, the first piece of commissioned art under the program found its home at the newly constructed Hilo State Office Building. And for today's quiz, we asked you to name the piece. Crafted by local artist Edward Brownlee, the Pili Poo sculpture was constructed from weathering steel. And at 8:11:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Local author Dan DiCarlo is in his late 80s, and he's old enough to remember when a few pennies earned shining shoes on the street could set you up for the whole day. He never lost his sense of the value of a dollar and the work it took to earn it over the course of a life that has taken him around the world. His story is told in his autobiography, My Mother Told Me, Watch Out for Those French Girls, the memoir of a very lucky man. We spoke about it a couple of weeks back.
I was born in an Italian family. Mm-hmm. They were immigrants, dad before the war, and World War I, and my mom after the war. They got married and raised a family of six children, and we were poor, extremely poor. But I overcame that in terms of working hard, shining shoes at 7 or 8 years old, and making 10 cents and then bringing it home and giving it to my mother. Mm-hmm. So we were taught the value of hard work and saving money. But educationally speaking, I was a very slow student and up to the fourth grade. And then finally they said, you're not going to make it. We're going to put you in a special ed class. But
yeah.
They didn't call it special ed in those days. They called it Miss Bash's dumbbell room.
Really?
I ended up in that for a year and a half, 2 years, and I made handiwork, crafts, which to this day has helped me because I can still do some of the things I learned in that fourth and fifth grade level of special ed.
But it's scary to be told at a young age that there's only so far you can go.
Well, yes, but it didn't strike me as not being successful. I was never thinking of growing up and being wealthy and having a good educational life. I just took it in stride. I was told I was dumb. I accepted it, and I did the best I could at that time. About the middle of the fourth grade, after 3 years of repeating the grades, they repeated grades in those days. They didn't move you up.
Yeah.
You stayed behind.
Mm-hmm.
And after the third year, I finally got a hold of myself somehow and started to apply myself. And then from then on out, I worked hard. I went to summer school and caught up with my grades. I skipped fifth grade and then went into the sixth grade. And then I skipped seventh grade by going to summer school for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
And finally got up with my age group.
Well, it sounds as if there was an awful lot of motivation that kicked in at that point.
Yes, certainly was, and I can't really pinpoint it, except that I woke up one day and said, I better apply myself and work hard. It was almost too late, but I made it,
yeah.
And I applied myself from then on out. But I had to apply myself from then on out. High school, college, graduate school, I really had to apply myself.
Making up for lost time.
Yes.
When you spoke of being quite poor when you were young, what do you think that does to you later in life? You know, if you've been really poor as a kid, it changes something. It has to, but how would you describe that change?
Well, you appreciate things more, I think. And maybe the best example I can give, I went through life. I came here. I became a substitute teacher, and I was at a local school, junior high school. It was raining. I was a PE teacher that day, a substitute, and we were outside the locker room waiting for the rain to subside, and there are puddles of water in front, and I looked down, and I saw an old nickels, dimes, quarters in the puddle of water there. And I said, hey, guys, look, there's some money there. Come on. Oh, they wouldn't touch it. Oh, that dirty rainwater. Well, I reached down, picked it up, went inside, washed it off, and I ended up with 97 cents.
Uh-huh.
I came back out, and I said, guys, I'm 97 cents richer than I was before a few minutes ago. You see, what you need to do, guys, appreciate. And that's been my attitude with working hard, trying to develop, and appreciate what you get.
You know, it almost makes it seem as if too much privilege early in life can be a handicap almost.
Yes, I didn't have that one, but I think it gets you to appreciate hard work. If you work hard, you can be successful. And as I say, I started early as a shoeshine boy, and every nickel, dime I made, I gave it to my parents. And then Saturday morning, they give me 10 cents to go to the movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so appreciative of that.
When you look at young people today, you know, from as you look back on your life, I'm sure, as have all of us, you made your share of mistakes. And as we get older, we sort of want to look at young people and say, don't make the mistakes that I made. If you could sort of reach out to, you know, a younger generation and say, avoid this, what were the things that you would counsel them to avoid?
Well... There's a lot more temptation now than when we were children. We didn't have television, so we didn't spend hours in front of a television. We had one radio in the house. We listened to one station, usually. For them to, it's difficult right now to explain, but... I just can't put my finger on it right now to explain it.
Well, you know what I'm saying, though, that you want to be able to, you know, we all have this sort of natural urge to say to people, don't make the mistakes I've made, or maybe follow this good advice that I happened upon, and this helped me.
Well, work hard. There's no substitute for work. Apply yourself. Save. Don't spend money on objects that are frivolous or not worthwhile.
Bright, shiny things.
Yes. But and work hard is the biggest thing. It's just apply yourself and work hard. Be dependable. I was always dependable. Never late for my shoeshine jobs. I worked in a shoemaker shop. I worked in a dollar store. And I'm talking when I was 10, 11, 12 years old. Unfortunately, kids today can't get jobs until they're 16 or 17 years old. Because of the work regulations. But in those days, I started to work around 7 years old, and I worked all my life.
Dan DiCarlo is the author of an autobiography, My Mother Said Watch Out for Those French Girls, published in 2016. There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, joins us for a look at events going on in our community. It might be a little under the radar. And if you're going to be in Kona tomorrow, you can learn the true story of a man who saved thousands of early manuscripts from being destroyed.
Yeah, this is an interesting story. The Nonfiction Book Club will meet to discuss the badass librarians of Timbuktu. And I did check, I can say Timbuktu on the air. It's by Joshua Hammer.
Okay.
And to save these centuries-old Arabic books from Al-Qaeda, a group of librarians in Timbuktu smuggles 350,000 of them out of the city to safety in southern Mali. And the book club meets at 6 p.m. tomorrow to discuss this interesting book in the Kona Stories bookstore in the Keoho Shopping Center. So please bring a poo-poo or beverage to share.
Those are some librarians, huh?
I know. They're very, you know,
they might even fit that description. And there's a concert on Kauai tomorrow for the benefit of Puerto Rico hurricane victims.
It is an intimate night of music featuring singer-songwriter Santiago Soto, Brad Stock, and guests. A portion of the proceeds will benefit Hurricane Relief Fund for Puerto Rico. This concert is from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Church of the Pacific in Princeville. And for ticket locations, you can visit our website.
And here's the author of a book on Kalapana having a reading tomorrow on Maui.
Under the Volcano, the People of Kalapana, 1823 to 2010, is an oral history that shares the memories of people who grew up in the area in the 1920s and 30s. Author Charles Longlas will read from his book tomorrow night at 6 at UH Maui College, Kalama Building, room 103.
Very different town before the lava flow came.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Balama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
This season in HPR's intimate concert space, four of Hawaii's top jazz pianists bring their unique stylings to the Atherton's magnificent Bösendorfer Grand. On December 9th, Tommy James performs the works of film composers. Think Henry Mancini, Johnny Mandel, and more. Visit hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, UH Professor Mita Chesney-Lynn joins us to talk about the power dynamic associated with sexual harassment. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HII Conversation. If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on our conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. You'll find that on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.